Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. Jackie Bluesy is a historical fiction writer originally from the Channel Island of Guernsey. She draws inspiration from atmospheric locations with intriguing histories and people, both real and imaginary, whose stories are calling out to be told. Her debut novel, The French House, was a Richard and Judy 2022 Winter Book Club pick. Her new novel, The Golden Hour, is set in the genteel squares and villas of Victorian Brighton and promises to be every bit as evocative and spellbinding as The French House. Welcome, Jackie.
Oh, thanks, Kate. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. Let's dive right in, if that's all right. Mm. Your upcoming book, The Golden Hour, let's talk about that. Can you tell me about the premise for the book?
Yeah, it's set, as you said, in Victorian Brighton in 1895. And it's about three women from three very different women from different classes, Clem, Ellen and Lily, who all get drawn in different ways into the underground world of erotic photography.
I'm in already. It's funny, as you're talking about that, my mind keeps turning to Sarah Waters, because she's written a fair amount now, hasn't she, set in Victorian England, and I love those. I mean, Tipping the Velvet, wasn't it, was obviously the first one,
yeah,
echoes of that. Why Victorian Brighton? Because I know obviously The French House is in your debut novel is set in the occupation of Guernsey. You're delving back further now. Why did you do that, and where did you get the idea from?
Well, I think after I'd written The French House, I'd spent, as we do as novelists, for quite a long time in that period in World War II, and so I definitely wanted to change. I didn't want to write about wartime anymore, so I wanted something that would refresh and sort of pique my imagination. And I sort of grew up loving Charles Dickens and the Victorian period. That's always a period of history that's, I just think it was like an incredible, there's incredible change that went on during those seven decades. That's where I was. I was also making a move from London to Brighton, and people sort of associate Brighton with the Regency period. But there's also, of course, you know, a lot of Victorian architecture here and Victorian housing and so on. So that was another reason. So I started doing some research, just sort of loose research into the Victorian period. And of course, that's in the late 1830s. That's when the first photograph that Fox Talbot sort of made the first negative, and then that new medium of photography really took off in the ensuing years. And I came across a man called, that's right, Sanborn, Linley Sanborn, and he was a cartoonist for Punch magazine. And I was reading a book about him, and he often used to take, he was also a very keen amateur photographer, and he had a dark room and so on, and he often used to take photographs of family members in different poses, quite flamboyant poses, that he would then copy for his illustrations. And so he was quite an interesting character of the day. He was a man about town, and I started reading up about him and found out, I mean, I didn't have to delve very deeply to find that he also had a proclivity for photographing nude
oh, really?
Women, yeah, almost always women, exclusively. And his wife, Marion, didn't seem to, if she was aware, she turned a blind eye to this. And it just got me thinking, there's not much that he writes about the models themselves, these young women who used to come and who he used to pay to photograph. And they seemed to come sort of from different backgrounds. And there was a footnote that greatly intrigued me. And I can't say much about it, as it's a bit of a spoiler in The Golden Hour. But it really got me thinking, it related to one of the models, and it really made me think, who are these women? How did they feel about what they were doing? Why were they there? What are their stories? And so that was what really set me in motion for the Golden Hour.
That's just fascinating, because I'm sure looking at those images now, they probably seem quite tame in a sense, don't they, by today's standards. But to kind of, to put it in context, that would have been a very scandalous thing to have done, wouldn't it? I'm guessing they would have had to slip into his studio under cover of night, or at least arrive looking respectable before disrobing.
Yeah. I don't think it actually happened at his house.
Oh,
I think
it
was I think it was different locations sort of around the city. And he was also part of a camera club, and I think, which is like a gentleman's club. And so I think a lot of the models went there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what was their motivation for women? I am assuming it would be financial.
Yeah, on the whole. And they came sort of a range of backgrounds, actually, which surprised me. So some of the women were artists, models. I was looking back through some records of census professions in a census, and you know, there were women that were putting down their profession as artist model. So, you know, it wasn't altogether an unrespectable thing to do, depending on who you were and what class you were from. And then, but I think the, you know, let's not romanticize this, the vast majority of the women that were doing it for financial reasons, as you say, and women who lived in poverty, who, I mean, you know, it's no big reveal. We all know that, you know, how difficult women's lives were at that time.
Yeah, I mean, options were limited, weren't they? They would have gone into domestic service, presumably, mm-hmm. if they were from that kind of background. So yeah. to be able to earn money for essentially, you know, posing for a static photograph, you can see the lure of it.
Yeah, yeah, but you're also sort of that lack of control, because you're not, you know, you've no idea what's going to happen to that image, where it's going to go.
And the vulnerability of being naked in a man's house who you don't know.
Yeah, absolutely, with them holding all the power. Prostitution was absolutely rife at the time, and I'm sure for some women it was an alternative to that, which, you know, was worse by far.
Yeah. And how did you begin then, Jackie, to go about researching this? And was it the case that that did you uncover that it was quite rife in Brighton, that this was somewhere that was particularly, you know, not hotbed, but it was, because obviously you tend to think of London, but I'm sure there must have been many of these, what did they call them, sort of carte de visite, or, you know,
those carte de visite. Yeah.
Formal photography, portrait, you know, portrait photographers.
I don't know if I'm, you know, sort of full disclosure, I don't know what the trade in erotic photography was like in Brighton itself. You know, haven't managed to sort of
uncover
that.
Seems like the sort
of
place that would have had it.
Well, exactly that. Yeah. I don't think it's too much of a stretch. Yeah. I mean, I just did sort of general research, really. And I think, you know, the actual sale and distribution of the photographs was nationwide, as far as I could work out. I mean, yes, there were hubs. I mean, in London, for Holywell Street, which doesn't exist anymore, but that was a street just off the Strand in London that was full of bookshops and was known for selling sort of a certain type of book.
Right. How interesting.
Yeah. And also sort of photographs as well. And you'd get sort of itinerant salesmen who would, you know, who would sell them. And yeah, so there was different sort of retail outlets, shall we say.
I mean, there would always be a trade for that, though, wouldn't there? Mm-hmm. You know, under the counter, slipped in a brown paper bag over the tabletop.
Yeah. And you
was ever thus.
Yes, absolutely. And you realize sort of as you do the research, you know, you come across things like snuff boxes. So a snuff box with, you know, a photograph of a naked woman under the lid, that sort of.
So the snuff box was almost like the merchandise in a sense.
Yeah,
it's just a way of utilizing those naked photography.
For example, yeah, it's a sort of wink of mischief. You know, you can imagine them being brought out at like a, you know, at a club, sort of with the cigars.
That's rich pickings for fiction, though, isn't it? You know, just what you're saying now is so enticing in terms of language and prose. You can really imagine it.
Yeah. And every object, it sort of tells a story, doesn't it? I mean, photographs, I find photographs fascinating anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it really, I just think in terms of feeding your imagination, the research for this novel was a real joy. It was really fascinating.
Because I think when I think of Victorian portrait photography, I don't know why, but because I set a book called The Wedding Girls, because wedding photography, particularly in Whitechapel in the East End of London, was huge buoyant market. It was such a thing, you know, people from the poorer quarters, it was a badge of honour to go to this specific portrait photographer, Boris Bennett, who'd been there since the Victorian ages, and everyone would dress up in their finery. It was a way of, no matter that you put the portrait photography on a damp, crumbling wall, it was a badge of honour. And people would really dress up, and he was quite the illusionist. You know, he would do these incredible backdrops all made out of paper and paste and cardboard and arrange, you know, extra tulle and all these, always aspidistra plants on sort of mahogany polished stands behind them to create this illusion of wealth and standing. Is that what you found? And I love the concept, therefore, with your book, that behind that there was this other side to it as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of what I wanted to look at, really, that you get, and you get these different, well, there's sort of hierarchy of photographers, really. So you get the seaside photographers, because by the time I'm writing in 1895, dry plate photography was the process that people were using, which gave everybody a lot more flexibility because than the wet plate, because you could develop, you didn't need to develop the photos immediately. You could have sort of makeshift darkroom with you. So it opened the technology up to a lot more people than it had previously, which meant that the sort of traditional photographers were very sniffy about, you know, the seaside photographers that you get down on the beach. And there was I came across a term, they call them smudgers.
Oh. what was that supposed to denote? The smudgers were a bit CD down market.
I think it's probably something to do with the process, actually, that their photography wasn't as sort of as sharp and as,
oh, crisp,
crisp and clean, and you know, it wasn't professionally done, that they didn't really quite know what they were doing.
Amazing world to immerse yourself in, though.
It really was. And of course, you know, you go down rabbit holes, don't you? The deeper you go, sort of the more you find out. Yeah, interesting.
Definitely. So, and one of my questions as well, Jackie, you obviously live in Brighton. You're originally from Guernsey, but you live in Brighton now. Was setting a novel on your doorstep a blessing or a curse?
it was very much a considered choice. It was a blessing, I'd say, definitely, because I moved down here relatively recently. So it was during the dark days of the pandemic, and I'd finished The French House, wanted to write another book, and was trying to think of a setting. And it was actually a kind of sort of housewarming present to myself to sort of set the book here, because it gave me a very sort of a way of connecting with this town that I didn't know very well. I didn't really know many people here either. And it the options for meeting people pretty limited sort of when we were all in lockdown. So it gave me, a real sort of focus and I really enjoyed sort of getting under the skin of Brighton. Yeah. You know, it was
I bet you see Brighton differently now, do you?
Yeah.
Because you're viewing it through the gaze as well, you know the Victorian history of it. You're much more in tune with the sort of heritage, I suppose, and the stories down that alley and what went on there by the pier.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You sort of look at the piers in a completely different light, and yeah, you sort of walk past sites that you think, oh yeah, there was a used to be the Alhambra Music Hall there, and now, you know, it's there's singers, it's sort of, you know, pub singers that are singing down by the seafront. So it's you've got the past and the present sort of backing up.
Yeah,
it's in your own imagination.
Yes, exactly. Which I love, though. I love that happens. But what, because obviously you're setting it in the Victorian era, there's nobody, you can't, like, I write books in World War II, set them in World War II, so I can go out and fortunately still interview people that are alive, but you would not have had that option. What was the challenges, therefore, of researching and writing a book in the Victorian period?
Well, exactly as you say, I think that, you know, that there was nobody to talk to. I couldn't commune with my ancestors. Well, I had to do what everyone does if you're writing, you know, sort of fiction that's set 100 years plus. I had to just really immerse myself in firsthand accounts at the time, sort of primary sources, you know, so newspapers, books and magazines, books that are written at the time, that was helpful. I did lots of, when we were able to sort of get out in the real world again, I did lots of trips to museums in London. So I went to the Museum of the Home in the East End, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with.
Yeah.
Yeah. V&A.
The one called the Jeffrey Museum.
It used to be. Yeah.
It used to be called the Jeffrey Museum.
Yeah. They've renamed it. And I went to the Women's Library at the London School of Economics. And that was really fascinating, actually, because in the golden hour, there was an association called the National Vigilance Association, which was a social purity group at the time. And this organization, I think it came out of the suppression of the Society for the Suppression of Vice. And it was, you know, it's quite an interesting sort of bunch of people. And there were branches, local branches that spread up, that started up all over the country. Really? It was an organization. It was a charity that did a lot of good. And one of their sort of missions was to really tackle prostitution and these young girls that were being sort of coerced, forced into prostitution. And so they, you know, they were very vigilant. And they also had campaigns against sort of keeping the music hall content appropriate, family appropriate.
Okay.
Yeah, so there was a real trend at the time for these, what they called living statues or tableau vivant,
Oh, yes.
where, yeah, I don't know if you're familiar.
I am, yeah, because it was quite the thing by the time of the Second World War as well. I mean, particularly clubs in Soho, women were not allowed to, the Windmill Club, it was all the tableaus, they weren't allowed to move
for fear of
breaching the Lord Chancellor's decree on moving, making models. So yeah, I am familiar with it.
Yeah. Well, that sort of began in Britain then. And so you'd get these women standing, they'd sort of pose, they sort of imitate Greek statues and be wearing these body stockings to get over the sort of the nudity laws.
Lots of wispy and, ship on and
yeah, absolutely.
Strategic placement of ostrich feathers.
Yeah. yeah. So the vigilants were not impressed by that. So they would campaign to remove these tableaus from the theatres without success. Yes, going back to the Women's Library. So I was able to go there and look through committee meeting minutes, which sounds kind of dry, but it absolutely wasn't.
Really?
It's just really, really fascinating to get in the heads of people who were...
Yeah. And get the thoughts and the innermost feelings and the language and the vernacular, isn't it, that really comes up.
Yeah.
So that tells you about the women who, I'm assuming, the vigilante society were probably middle class. Was it a struggle to find reflections, memoirs, thoughts of working class women or women that wouldn't have had a choice but to, for financial, economic reasons, to take their clothes off and pose in these things? What was that a struggle to find... first-hand or accounts from women like that?
Yeah, I mean, next to impossible.
Really?
Well, first-hand accounts,
yeah.
I'd say, because they're not...
They weren't writing their books, were they?
No, of course
nobody
not.
Nobody was rushing up, lining up to interview them.
No, but there are sort of ways that you can... So there was somebody, I've forgotten his name, but he was a journalist at the time, and he went around sort of the slums in the East End and wrote reports on life for people who were impoverished, living in impoverished circumstances. From that, you get sort of anecdotes. So you get a good sense of how people were living.
And it would have been the same in Brighton as opposed to London, wouldn't it, I guess?
Yeah, and the sort of challenges that they were up against. And I got a lot of information about that actually from the Vigilance Society minutes, because there would be certain cases. So there'd be cases of young women who they were trying to help who had got into trouble of some sort. So in that way, you really have to, you know, you have to kind of use your imagination. There's not that much, certainly that I could find, that was out there.
And that makes it an extra challenge for you as the writer, isn't it? To get yourself into the skin and the thoughts of a woman of that period.
The opinions of the working class or the image that you get is everything is sort of told through the prism, as you're saying, of the sort of middle class women in the Vigilance Association. It's through their eyes, or this journalist's eyes, although, you know, he was more objective, he was coming at it from an objective angle, but still.
But that's why it's wonderful that I suppose that we do have fictionalized accounts of that, because it does give us an ability to put ourselves in the shoes of women like that and begin to have some empathy towards those possible situations that many women found themselves in.
Yeah.
Natasha, I love surprises in history, and I feel that you sort of instinctively or feel the same, you know, teasing out and exploring the lesser known elements of 20th century history, like the occupation of the Channel Islands and in the golden hours of boundary crossing female music hall artists. Do you consciously seek out the forgotten or the stories that you feel haven't been represented enough in fiction?
No, not consciously, I wouldn't say. I think it's just something I don't want to tell. I try and avoid cliches as far as possible. Yeah. Cliched characters and cliched plot lines, because that's not the kind of story that interests me to write, and those aren't the characters that I'm motivated to write about or to research, really. So I think that's sort of my starting point, that I need to write characters that I need to discover, really, you know, that are different somehow. And they're not, I mean, whoever you write about, there's always more to absolutely everybody, the most ordinary person, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, no one is normal. There is no such thing.
No, that's absolutely certain. And that was very much true of The French House, your debut novel, because one of your protagonists was deaf. So talk us a bit about that for those that haven't read The French House.
Mm. So the French House, it's set, as you were saying, during the Second World War, during the occupation, German occupation of the Channel Islands. It's set on Guernsey. It's loosely inspired by family history. And it's about two estranged lovers, Emile, who is deaf after an accident in Canada, and Isabelle. And they're both trapped in unhappy marriages. They're in middle age. They're marriages that are unhappy in different ways, but nonetheless unhappy. And their paths cross again at the French House of the title, which is in fact a real place, Hopeful House on Guernsey, which is Victor Hugo's, well, was Victor Hugo's residence in exile when he was exiled in Guernsey in the late Victorian period for 15 years. So Emile and Isabella there at the house, working there. Their paths cross with Schreiber, Lieutenant Schreiber, who's a German press censor. So he censors the Guernsey press, and he is billeted with Isabel in her house. And so it's really about sort of the relationship between the three of them. And they're all very much sort of outsiders, really, I'd say, in lots of ways, sort of isolated.
Mm. Description, yeah. Did you feel, because coming from Guernsey, obviously my next book is set in Jersey in the Channel Islands, and I always sort of often think, oh, it's quite difficult not having come from there. I wish I came from there. I wish I had that collective sense of family history. But then it got me thinking, well, actually, in some ways, does that make it harder? Because did setting a novel in the island of your birth come with a kind of weight of expectation with it?
Yes, in some ways, I suppose that's true, because you don't have much distance. My mother's side of the family sort of were Guernsey, generations of her family lived in Guernsey. So I spent a lot of time in my research for that novel. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was still alive at the time, and she lived through the occupation as a young woman. I mean, I'm indebted to her, really, because she had lots of stories to tell, and there was nothing particularly, to be honest, there wasn't anything that dramatic, but it's just, she was very good at remembering the sort of the day-to-day, you know, the details and how people felt, and that really builds this sort of picture.
And I got that from your novel. There was such a richness and a depth and an authenticity to those scenes.
Oh, thank you.
And to the plot.
At the same time, when I was writing it, I wasn't published. And although I very much wanted to be and hoped that this book would be the one, I sort of kept it under my hat a bit. I didn't, you know, I tried not to get too sort of distracted by the thought of readers.
Mm.
You know,
and that's quite a nice comfort blanket in a way, isn't it? With that, I think that's if you interview many authors, that debut novel, because you're writing, as I think Stephen King said, you're writing with the door shut. That first draft, you don't have the weight of thinking, oh God, what are people going to think about? Will they read this? Because you don't think at that point that it will get published.
Yeah, yeah,
you're
it's quite
freeing. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, and then you do lose that, don't you? As I read, like, when you're writing your second one.
Oh, yeah, suddenly.
For you, you've written several.
Yeah, you're aware of lots of people in the room with you, clustered around, like observing your everyone. Mm. That's so interesting. And I love that you got a lot of information from, did you say your maternal grandmother?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, because that was the challenge for me when I went out to Jersey. And, you know, obviously you're aware of the occupation, there's signs of it everywhere, isn't there, in the bunkers and the German fortifications, which are everywhere. Yeah. They were massively overfortified, the Channel Islands. But for me, you know, like, history isn't about the guns and the bunkers and so forth. It's about oral history and people. And I always felt, and still do, that the most powerful reminders of the occupation come from the people themselves. So for you, I suppose, in a sense, your grandmother being there, and I'm sure she was always keen to share stories with you, you didn't have to look too far.
No, absolutely not. And growing up in the 70s, my grandfather was also there during the occupation. And they would always, you know, it was, not saying that every time we had a family gathering we'd talk about the occupation, but it was talked about quite a bit, because it was only sort of 30 years earlier, you know.
Yeah, that, which is nothing really, is it?
No, not in the scheme of things. And so there'd be lots of, I think, I do remember my grandfather, so we'd be sitting around having Christmas lunch, and he always would make a comment about the sort of the excess of food as he saw it. You know, I think there was a lot of really associated trauma with having gone through the occupation, and, you know, slowly starving, really, which was what was happening. If it hadn't been for the Red Cross ship, the Vega, that came in sort of early 1945, you know, people were really, you know, had no idea what might happen to them.
I was very taken aback at that, actually. That was an aspect of the occupation that I wasn't aware of. And I think probably, I suspect a lot of people aren't, how close to the starvation point islanders were, especially after D-Day and, you know, the food supplies from France were and French ports were cut off. People were literally, I think, what was it, Churchill said, let them rot on the vine. Obviously, he was referring to the German garrison, but it, hand in hand with that, islanders starved too.
And they must have felt very isolated and forgotten by...
Did you get a sense from listening to your grandfather that there was anger towards the British government, Whitehall, Churchill, that they had been forgotten?
Yeah, I think there was, because just before the Germans occupied, there was a case of sort of crossed wires, I believe. So the islands had been demilitarized, but somehow the Germans hadn't. This message hadn't quite got through. And so there was a bombing of the White Rock, which is the harbour in Guernsey. And when on a Friday evening, when a lot of the tomatoes and other produce were lined up for export to the UK. And so, you know, there was several casualties and deaths, and, you know, which could have been avoided, completely avoided. So, you know, that was just sort of one example of, I think there, you know, there was anger, and then they were just left.
I mean, there was no communication, was there? People's wirelesses were confiscated. It was very difficult. They must have felt, it must have been very lonely and isolating, I think.
I mean, I think to begin with, people did have their wirelesses, but they were taken away after a while. And that's when people had to improvise and make their own.
So the Channel Islands as well, it seems to be, certainly this is my understanding of anyway, very much up until, well, really, you know, is framed by that kind of clumsy narrative of collaboration versus resistance, which I was surprised at how contentious that is even to this day. On one of my research trips over, I did a tour around with a tour guide, and he was telling me how this Irish nurse had said to him, "What's a jerry bag?" And he'd explained to her what it was. And she said that in the elderly care home where she worked, she said a woman had come in, this was only recently, and was going to live in this care home. And as she walked into the communal lounge, all the elderly women turned their backs on her. Because she had been a jerry bag. Even today, you know, the memories are obviously long, aren't they? And I think my understanding is that occupations sort of inject poison into those areas. So that for these women, it was still as contentious, you know, in 2020 or whenever that was, as it was back in during the Second World War. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I mean, I'm not saying that happens everywhere. That's quite an extreme.
Yeah, I mean, that surprises me in some ways, but you're absolutely right that it's still extremely contentious and emotive today. And I think there are, you know, there's often a frustrating lack of subtlety in the narrative of collaboration versus resistance. And you get people sort of saying, well, why wasn't it, you know, comparing it to comparing the Channel Islands to occupied France,
is impossible to do,
which is like a crazy comparison. Like, as you know, they're tiny, there was resistance. There was resistance in lots of different small ways.
Yes, it wasn't organized like the French resistance. But then that wasn't possible because there were no vast forests to hide in, was there? And there was, was it, one to every three or four islanders, one German, versus France, where every 100 civilians, one German. So there was a huge concentration of German soldiers, wasn't there? And so, you know, resistance, as you saw in France and occupied Europe, just wasn't possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, I think people don't quite realise that. And another thing, it's quite annoying, really, that collaboration. Often the first place people go with that, which I think is quite misogynistic, is they think of women, local women having affairs with German soldiers, you know, and that, you know, yes, that undoubtedly went on. I mean, but we don't know. None of us know how we would have behaved in a situation like that. And I think people, you know, people were doing what they had to do to survive. Yeah. And also, you know, Guernsey is a small community, and a lot of the Germans that came in, the occupying forces, basically were, you know, they didn't want to be there any more than the Guernsey people wanted them there. Yeah. And a lot of them were young and, you know, away from home, away from their families. And what you don't hear so much about is, so on every year, as I'm sure you know, Liberation Day is still a public holiday in the Channel Islands and is celebrated, and they have parades and so on. And there's a lot of Germans that come back.
Yeah, that's a side that's not often talked about and discussed, is it? The links that were forged in the post-war years.
Yeah, and there were
a lot
links.
Of great friendships made.
Exactly, friendships. Yeah, I do understand why there's such a sort of strength of feeling still amongst the sort of the descendants of people who were there during the occupation.
Yeah, but I think, and you're right, it's slightly misogynistic, because collaboration isn't just, as was so often the case, a young, you know, impressionistic, probably lonely woman seeking solace and a bit of fun in the arms of a young, equally naive German. It was also farmers who might have been collaborating with Germans. It might be people selling items on the black market. Collaboration doesn't just extend to the jerry bag, confined to the jerry bag narrative. And yet that's the one that is most memorable, isn't it? This feeling of people going around putting tar swastikas on women's houses, that are branding them essentially jerry bags.
Yeah, and there's also, what about informers? There were people that would inform
on their
neighbours and so on.
Yeah, I found that amazing. That's what really underpins my book, is about one of my protagonists works at Jersey Postal Office. And because I came across this very small plaque in the underground museum in Jersey, basically commemorating and applauding the actions of Jersey postal workers who, when a letter came in bound for the German commandant or for the German secret field police, would steam it open. And if it was a letter from a poison pen letter or somebody being denounced, whilst they cycled around on their rounds delivering letters, they'd also deliver a little warning saying, "You've been denounced, we'll hold the letter back 24 hours, get rid of your wireless," or whatever. I love that.
Yeah, I love those. Yeah. I've heard that story. It's
resistance. Did the same thing happen in Guernsey?
I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. I have heard that story about Jersey, and it is. Yeah, I mean,
it's a wonderful resistance story, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wish more was made of resistance in all the Channel Islands, really, because my sense of it is, like you say, it wasn't organised to the scale it was on the continent, but it was very much an organic sort of network of people who worked together to thwart the Germans wherever they could and in whatever way that they could.
Yeah, and there was, there are examples of real bravery. And I can't remember, it's been a while since I did the research for this novel, obviously, so I can't remember the names on
your head's in the golden hour.
But yeah, my head's in the golden hour and the next one
is done, you're on the next.
But there was this woman, I think her first name was Marie. She was a member of the Salvation Army.
Yes.
And have you heard of her? Gatherings were forbidden, gatherings of more than, I don't know, I don't know the number, but probably
it was more than five, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty low, wasn't it? And a low number. And so she would, she would call together groups of people and preach and come up. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what the content of her.
I think she was very outspoken about the Germans' treatment of slaves and forced labourers.
Okay, right,
to help build the fort, well, not help, they were forced over to build the fortifications. And she saw that, and like a lot of Channel Islands, was repulsed at the state and the condition of them, so would stand out, and was very vociferously outspoken against treatment of these slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was enough, wasn't it, to land her in hot water.
Yes, and I think she died in a concentration camp. She was deported.
Yeah, and she wasn't the only one, was she? As we were talking before we came on air about another lady called Louisa Gould, who helped to harbour an escaped Prussian slave, was denounced. Actually, that letter that was, she was pre-warned about her denunciation thanks to the post office, but unfortunately the clear-up job wasn't quite good enough, and they found a Russian-English dictionary left behind.
And that
was enough to seal her fate. And she ended up she was deported first to St. Malo, I think, and then ended up in Ravensbrück, dying in the gas chamber. So you don't think of Channel Islanders dying in concentration camps.
No.
Yet it happened.
So
I wish that were better known.
Yeah, no, you're right. Those stories of small, and there'll be just myriad others.
That we don't know about. Yeah. Why is it, do you think, Jackie, that women have this sort of voracious appetite for historical fiction? It seems, especially at the moment, World War II, but I think also World War I. Mm. What does it fulfil in us, do you think?
Mm. Do you mean sort of readers, writers?
Readers. Well, maybe writers as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something seductive about recent past, isn't there? Where I think it's connection, I would say, connection with people from the time. You know, we think about our family. We all have, family that were alive in the Second World War, in the First World War. There's family stories that have passed down. And in most cases now, those people will have gone, definitely gone, the First World War. And so it's a way of, I think, just trying to connect, trying to understand, trying to make sense of what happened. I mean, these big sort of seismic world events that changed everything.
Yes.
And if history had been different, we wouldn't be here, you know.
Yeah, just 10 degrees of difference either way.
Yeah.
Those momentary fleeting choices, what would we have done, I suppose.
So I'd say it was that. I mean, in some ways, it's curious, isn't it? Because it seems there is an insatiable appetite for World War II stories.
Yeah, there
is. In particular.
Definitely. You only have to look on Amazon to see, you know, click on one and then get suggested, you know, 50 more. I wonder if it's worth, in a weird sort of way, seeking reassurance from the past, because today is so polarized and uncertain. We've lived through the pandemic now, you know, nothing feels secure any longer, that perhaps looking back at the way that women coped, you know, that, and there is this myth, isn't there, around World War II, that it was our greatest moment in history, and we there was victory to be had. It's such a moment of national pride, isn't it, I suppose, that it's somewhat glorified, that we tend to look back on those periods and think, well, that's when we were great.
Yeah, the nostalgia.
That's a good word, nostalgia.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's definitely some of that, that it's all sort of neatly packaged up, isn't it?
Yeah.
And comforting. Yeah. It's comforting.
Yes, absolutely. It's comforting. Mm. Yeah. Because I was at a sort of I suppose it was a vintage festival. It was called Salute to the 1940s at Chatham Dockyards over the weekend. I was there selling books on a stand with my friend who was selling vintage material. And there were so many young women there in vintage, authentic 1940s outfits, clearly reveling in the time period, loving, I suppose, the escape into another era. I was really surprised. I imagined it would be older people, but no, lots of young women. That really took me by surprise.
Yeah, well, I suppose that sort of makes sense to me, that it's that you're young, that it would be younger women, because they don't really know that. I mean, the reality, let's face it, like the reality of living through the occupation, for example, is not something that anyone would really want to repeat, any more than you'd want to like romanticize living through a pandemic. Not that I'm comparing the two, but it's a real romanticization of the past, isn't it? And you know, I suppose in some ways I'm just as guilty as the next person, because I wrote a love story set during the occupation. But
But your occupation story was very authentic. You know, you really could feel the desperation, the starvation, the hardship, the boredom, the loneliness, the fear. It was nothing. I mean, the slog of it.
Yeah, you know, slog is the right word.
Yeah. And the
slog.
The stuff. I mean, I interviewed quite a few islanders, and just to hear those stories about, you know, so hungry, you know, just living off turnips and swede and
acorn tea and
you know, one woman I interviewed who said that suddenly her dog disappeared, Beauty, and they knew it had been, you know, eaten. Probably she blamed the German sort of garrison that was nearest to her, but the dog had been shot and eaten. People don't, you know, we forget that level of starvation.
Yeah The pets aren't safe.
Yes. Anyway, we've gone off on somewhat of a tangent there. I'll come back to writing life, shall I? One of the things I love as well about your writing is that characterization. Those characters are real. How do you create such real, fully fleshed out characters?
Thank you for saying that. Well, my books are very much character led. So I generally sort of start with a main character who really sort of appears to me in some way. I mean, it's not to say that I know them and I know their backstory, but I have a sort of image of them. Emile in the French House, I could sort of see him there, this accordion that he used to play when he could hear was sort of washed up on a beach. It was, the keys were sticky with sand, and there was a real feeling of sort of melancholy and trauma. And it was that sort of image that took me to him and to his psyche, really. I don't think there's any sort of shortcuts. I would say that when you're developing character, I think you have to sort of spend time with your characters and get to know them. You just have to sort of, like you would with anyone.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, I don't know if you feel the same, but writing a first draft, I mean, I always hate my first drafts. They're just like, writing feels terrible and wooden. Yeah. And the characters cardboard thin, but you're sort of getting, that doesn't really matter in the scheme of things because you're getting to know these people.
Because it's any friendship, isn't it? I suppose when you meet someone, you don't know them instantly straight away. Friendships develop over years.
Yeah, that's right. And
find it's the same with your characters.
Mm. Mm. So I'd say, I don't rush that character development. I sort of spend quite a lot of time thinking about it. And there's lots that I write that never, ever finds its way into the book.
Yeah. I think people that will always amaze people. And so many writers on this podcast have said the same, that, there's huge swathes of stuff that gets cut out. It doesn't get put into the bin. It just gets parked somewhere else. Mm, but whether that be research or characterization, it never makes it to the final cut, but it's a necessary part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I have no idea how many words you write in order to get like a 90,000 word book. Double that, probably in my case. Yeah.
So it is like that though, isn't it? And then it's a process of chopping it down, layering it up. It's not linear, is it?
no, absolutely not. I think people probably think it, and I'm sure I did before I started writing myself, you think it's far more linear as a process than it's going to be, but stories don't come fully formed, or they don't to me. Maybe there's some writers they do, but so it's layering, isn't it?
And often when I look, because quite often I find myself in a situation where I have to write a synopsis for the next book, and often when I finish that book and I look back over the synopsis, it's a different book, different characters, different things happen. You just have to go on that journey with them and be open and flexible enough to let your characters go where they will often demand it by the end.
Yeah, that's right. It's completely right.
On to the subject of plotting. I love asking the other authors this because everybody says such a different thing. Do you plot in advance? Do you know where you're going? Or do you just have a rough framework, like a beginning, middle and end? Some of them just sit down and go, I don't know what's going to happen in this story. They just have a character in mind and off they go.
No, well, I made that mistake once and never again. That's my unpublished first novel. I did that.
Oh, really?
It's more fun to write, I think, when you're just you're free flowing. But no, I sort of plan. I do plan. So I know the main kind of beats of the story. So I divide it. And normally the way I do it is I divide it into three acts. So I have this sort of three act structure with a midpoint where everything changes, and the first act climax, and then the second act climax, and then you're the darkest hour, and in those sort of crude storytelling terms. But I like to know how it ends. I think I do like to have an end point in mind.
Yeah. I think with historical fiction, that's kind of necessary because history dictates where, in a sense, like, you wrote those books in the occupation, that the ending will be on or around Liberation Day.
Yeah.
Or it could come later, but that is your kind of, it's set in stone somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, that can be quite helpful, actually. I mean, I think there's lots of people that don't write historical fiction often think, why would you do that? You've got to do all this research. But I actually think it helps the process. That you've got vast reserves of information to draw on that can actually really help you with the plotting.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely would agree with that. And I often have a timeline where I put the major events that have happened, and I keep referring back to it. So I'm aware of the backdrop, what my characters are living, thinking, breathing and feeling, and what's happening in the backdrop of it. And you might not, all that information won't work its way into the pages, but it certainly informs it. And I think you can feel it. If a book's been really well researched, it kind of reverberates through the pages. The author has understood the themes and the sort of detail and the nuances of it.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree.
So that's interesting. So you're not a panster, as they call it, but are you?
No.
And I often will see it on Instagram and things where people have done such a level of plotting. There's always copious amounts of post-it notes, and that I find quite frightening. Because I've never managed to achieve that either. You plot to such a degree?
No, I don't. Partly because I haven't got anywhere to put post-it notes.
For your post-it notes.
No, I don't do that. And I don't use any software. I know some people do. I can't remember. Is there one called Scrivener?
No, there is. I don't use that either. That's yeah, just that for me.
Yeah, it's a bit of a turn off to me. I don't want to use a spreadsheet. It just feels too
clinical,
too much like work. Or
yeah, I agree. I tend to have a mood board sometimes. I did for the occupation one, and I just put on it things like a map of where my characters lived, and just printed off loads of photographs as well of people. And that kind of, I just could look at it, and in a minute I could see, oh, well, then if she lived there, she'd have had to walk past that shop. And that's the sort of thing that people were wearing. And these were the names of the shops and the advertising hoardings and that sort of thing. It's a very visual reminder of where you are and where your character's walking.
Yeah, I find that helpful too, photographs. I do have like the gold now. I've got a few photographs around of sort of music hall artists. Yeah, for the book I'm writing at the moment, I've got a couple of photos on my screensaver. So something to sort of get you in the zone when you're sitting down to write. Mm.
And on the subject of the book you're writing at the moment, are you able to talk about that at the moment, or you'd rather keep that under wraps?
Well, it's at a very early stage. It's called Black Feather, is the working title. And it's set during the First World War this time, against the backdrop of the British silent film industry.
Oh, wonderful. That sounds like you'll have more fun researching like that. Instantly, when you say Black Feather, instantly I just think of the white it makes me think of the white feather that people were given when they were sort of branded as cowards. Was that deliberate? Play on that?
I can't say much more at the moment.
No, okay,
yeah, you're absolutely that's the right reaction,
but it's very intriguing
title,
I really cannot wait to read that one as well. Now, just lastly, I'm aware of the time. We've been rabbiting on for a while, so I'm gonna I always ask my interviews three payout questions. What was your, and I know there'll be more than one, you can say more than one if you want, favourite childhood books or book? What stands out?
Oh, yeah. I was a big fan of, funnily enough, historical fiction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, well, it wasn't historical at the time. But so I really loved Edith Nesbit. And she wrote lots and lots of books, but she wrote The Phoenix and the Carpet. She wrote Five Children and It, which was a series about this group of children, Edwardian family, and they find this creature called a Samiad in a sandpit, who grants some wishes, these children, and they go and they make all these kind of crazy wishes, like, we'd like to be as beautiful as the day, and then they get into all kinds of scrapes because, you know, the wishes never, be careful what you wish for. So
that's a wonderful, I've never read that. I would, it almost sounds like it's worth reading it now though.
Yeah,
as so many of those childhood books are. And what about a library? Did you go to the library in Guernsey growing up? Is the library in Guernsey like? I know all about the library in Jersey, but not so much Guernsey.
Okay, yeah, they've got an amazing Victorian library called the Gilorle Library, and it's got I did go a lot as a child. I visited again recently, actually, because the Guernsey Literary Festival is held there, or some of the events are held there. And it's really, not only is it beautiful, and it's in a beautiful Victorian building, but it's got fascinating history. So Mr. Gill and Mr. Orley, two friends, and Mr. Gill, can't think of his first name, but he went off to New York, and he was an apprentice to a carpenter. And he, while he was there in New York, he had access to a lot of the city libraries, because I think they had apprentices' libraries. And he was absolutely wowed by them. And he made a pact. And then his friend, another Guernseyman, Mr. Orley, came across. And they made a pact that when they returned to Guernsey, they would set up a library, a public library for the island. And that's exactly what they did.
How amazing. I had absolutely no idea. That's a novel, isn't it?
I know.
That should be your next novel after Black Feather.
I mean, it is a really incredible story. And so they did all kinds of things there. And it's got lots of, it's also a museum, really. It's got lots of lovely collectible pieces and artwork. So a real gem, a real sort of community public library. And the great thing about it is that it's kept up with the times. So now, you know, it's a sort of thoroughly modern library. It's very welcoming to everybody. It's got a lovely children's section, hosts literary events. So
I must visit. And how interesting it's still in its original premises, because obviously in Jersey, the Jersey Public Library was in the Royal Square. It was in one of the public buildings there, and obviously it's moved now because it needed a bigger, more modern premises. But And I managed to visit the old library, which is now part of the States of Jersey. And it's beautiful, but it's a gorgeous domed building with sort of mezzanine reading rooms and huge stained glass. But no one ever sees it. It's just, I think it's where the jury go now to deliberate on cases. So you'd never know. Yeah. So it seems sad to me. So it's good to hear that Guernsey's still up and running in its original, you know, modern, you know, community library, but in an old historic building.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And if you were sent off to a desert island with only one book, what would it be?
Well, this is a very difficult question, isn't it? Because one book isn't going to be enough. I would have to go for something like Great Expectations by Dickens, because, you know, it's a big tome of a novel. So it would, you know, that would bear several rereadings, I think. Yeah.
That and is the writer's choice. I can't tell you how many times people...
Is it really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Always Dickens, yeah.
Yeah, I think, and particularly that book is brilliant. Like, the characters are just completely unforgettable. It's got a great plot. It's got all the ingredients that you want, I think, from good fiction.
That's a great answer. Jackie, thank you so much for your time, taking time out of your busy schedule. I really appreciate it. And I cannot wait for people to listen to this and read The Golden Hour, and if they haven't already read it, The French House, because they're in for an absolute delight. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's been a real pleasure.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.